Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. I'm here today in Old Windsor with Hazel Cooper, who's kindly agreed to talk to me about the death of her husband, Jock. Would you like to start, Hazel, by telling me a bit about him?
It's very difficult to describe someone you've lived with. Or you're just so used to them.
How long were you together?
We were married for 63 and three quarter years.
Oh, that is a long time.
So we got married quite young, in our early 20s, and we were blessed with three boys. And having come from an all-female family, because my father died when I was seven, and there was my mother, my sister, myself, I was then landed with a very male family.
Yes, yes.
At the beginning of our marriage, there were some difficulties. He had a very bad temper, and it could show itself, and he got very upset. But I got used to that. And gradually we managed to work round it, and he calmed down. Or perhaps I wasn't, or I learned not to provoke him so much. I remember being very pleased very early on in our marriage that I'd made a rather spiteful remark, and he'd reacted very strongly. And I thought, oh, he's not going to let me get away with that. That's good. So, you know, it was a bit to's and fro's, but he was very caring. I know my mother had said to me before I got married, she said, I don't want you back here. Those days, you didn't get divorced. It just wasn't done, although there were quite a few. It was starting to become more usual. So that, our age group, that was rarely in our minds. So it was, once you were married, and that was where you stayed. And I think that was the mindset with which I grew up. My mother was only married for 12 years because my father was killed during the war, and she never married again. There weren't a lot of spare men around, of course, after the war, of her age group. So I suppose I was brought up with the consistency of her always being there, it being our small little family, my sister, my mother and myself. And Jock's family was a bit more old-fashioned than mine. His father was, you do what I say, I think. And his mother never went out to work. And I don't think she had any money. I think she had housekeeping. And I think that was it.
That was the way, wasn't it?
Exactly. But of course, my mother was an independent lady, earning her own money. She was a mother with children and no man.
And a working mother.
A working mother, that's right, yes.
Yeah. So you had two different examples of wives, didn't you?
Exactly, yes.
Two very different
examples. That's perceptive.
So did that influence how you were as a wife, do you think?
I didn't meditate on it. I just knew that's how you did it. You stayed and you worked at it. Mum said, that man's used to a cooked breakfast every morning, you'd better give him one. So I'd get up and cook him his breakfast. She was a rock. She was so supportive. And I think she enjoyed having a man in the family now. And then, of course, she would talk through things that were complicated in her life if she had trouble with electricity or the building works or something like that. She liked being able to talk to a man about that, I think. And she had a great respect for what he said. I think I, in lots of ways, underestimated him in that respect, though he was very good at keeping us in funds, although he spent hours on the books, which drove me mad. But on the other hand, you know, he managed to get enough money together to take us away every year on holiday, which was great. And once we'd persuaded him that it didn't have to be the Lake District every year, we could actually go across the Channel. Then we had trouble getting him out of France because he fell in love with France. And then we had this wonderful opportunity to go to China, which was something to do with a Catholic priest that put an article in a paper saying he was just looking for English native speakers to work in China. And I replied, and we came back with an invitation. Yes, you could come and work. They'll pay your fare, and they will actually pay you while you're there. And it wasn't, you know, a huge amount of money. But he didn't want to go until someone said to him, not me, oh, what a wonderful chance. And he began to realise that perhaps it would be all right. But anyhow, he came. And we both had a year in China at this school in a place called Zhaoqing, which is west of Guangzhou, which is up the Pearl River from Hong Kong. It was only a year, and it was a chance to live in another culture.
So tell me about more recent times. Did he become ill?
He had cancer of the colon. So he had part of his colon removed. He had the sigmoid, I think it is. And then he had another cancer, a primary cancer, again of the colon. And this time they had to take nearly all of it out. I was also very annoyed because it meant he lost his beer belly and he looked nice and slim. But it was a bit of a drastic way to go about it. And then he finished up with a bag. It was actually an ileostomy rather than a colostomy. And he did have some trouble with his bags. But he didn't make a fuss about it. I think when he made a fuss, it was in the house. So, of course, it was, if he was upset or anything, I got the back end of it. But then that is what marriage is about. You let off when you're with the people you know and love so much. So you keep a brave face once you're outside your front door. And then he got a cancer in his mouth. And these are all first primary cancers. And he had to have his top jaw of his mandible taken away. I think they should have, well, I think they could have done more for him. But looking back, it's much easier to say that he meant he had locked jaw, so he couldn't open his mouth very, very, very wide. And he did have trouble eating. So over these last few years, it was very difficult for him. Originally, I used to mash everything and blend it so it was easy to eat, and then in the end fork mashing would do, and eating things small and soft. But it meant he didn't enjoy his food as much as he had in the past, poor love. So he had that to put up with as well. So he had a lot of problems. And then it was the Christmas 22 and the beginning of 23. We were both in and out of hospital for different things. Our youngest lives with us, and he was calling the ambulance, and they were saying, yes, I think you're right to do this. We'll take him in. But I watched him over those few months gradually going down, and I had it in my head, you know, he's going. So that was a help. It was a preparation that he wouldn't be with me much longer. So I do think that helped. But of course, when he went, it was still a shock. It always is, even when you're in such pain that you want them to go. And he went very peacefully. He was in palliative care by then. But they promised me he wasn't suffering. It didn't seem to be suffering. The worst thing was his mouth was so dry. Had to keep mopping it with a sponge so that he could get a little liquid. And he couldn't open his mouth. So that was a problem with that too. So I couldn't wish for him to come back, not like that. He would have been in such distress.
So it obviously still distresses you, but it's kind of mixed emotion, isn't it?
It is, yes. I know he's okay. I say goodnight to him every night. And it's, as I said, it's his anniversary next week. And the three boys will be with me, which would be great. But I can't wish for him back. But I do. I feel very lonely. It's strange because it is your other half. And you just lost. You want to say, oh, I must tell Jock that. Oh, Jock would have liked that. He'd have been pleased. We weren't apart very much. We never went on holiday alone. Well, I did once when I visited my father's grave in Malta with Mum once. He didn't get on well without me. I remember it. I think I'd had a retreat day or something away, and the boys said he was not good without me. So I felt responsible that I shouldn't leave him alone too much. I think I thought that was part of the contract, part of my job. That's what I was here for.
And that makes it so much harder, doesn't it, when you're separated finally, because you've been so used to being together for so long. And like you said, he is your other half.
Yes. There's this eternal gap.
And like half has been cut away.
Absolutely. It is physically almost like that.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm a little bit further down the road than you, but not a lot, 4 or 5 months further on.
Not long.
But I don't know whether you ever lose the urge to tell your other half all the things, the little things that happen in the course of a day.
Yes.
Because you've been so used to doing it for so long.
But I used to work for Cruise and do bereavement counselling. And I thought, you know, I'd lived with a widow all these years. But it's not until it actually hits you between the eyes. And in lots of ways, it was an easy death. He was dying for some time. So I was prepared. So I was very fortunate from that point of view. It didn't come as a sudden shock like in a car accident or any accident, which must be mind-bending. That.
Did you feel you had the time to tell him everything you wanted to talk about everything you wanted to?
Yes. I think we shared so much over the years. I know he went on to a four-day week at one stage, flexible working it was called, and I was working for John Lewis, and they always shut on the Mondays. So he took Monday as his day off. Someone asked me what we did on the Monday, so I said, we talk. And I think a lot of my views have come from him, possibly via the paper he read. But my outlook, I'm sure, have been shaped by his ideas and his thoughts.
And that's what makes it so hard to be without them, doesn't it? Because yeah. If you shared those views as well as your lives, mm-hmm. that would automatically be the person you'd discuss it with.
Yes.
Discuss everything with.
Yes, that is so true. And the boys are good, and I'm so, so blessed having Ryan actually living with me. But we don't talk as much, or I probably talk more with Andy, because perhaps it's because he comes more, but he comes and goes more. So when he comes, it's a matter of talking more. But I do miss that. Last Christmas was the first Christmas without him. And I had Brian and Andy here. And they kept saying things like, when Dad was here, he'd do that. And they'd go and do it. And they were sort of carrying him forward.
Going back to when he was dying, you did mention to me earlier that you had a worry or a question mark hanging over that discussion about whether he was dying or not.
Yes, he didn't address it to me, but to one of the boys. They took it in turns to be with him through the night. And I think Andy was with him that night. And he said to him, I'm dying, aren't I? And I can't remember what Andy answered. I think he just said, yes, I'm afraid you are. And that was it. But I would like to have known what would have helped him. Whereas I have a strong faith, even though it wobbles a lot, I never thought of him as having a strong faith. But he prepared his own funeral, and it was beautiful. All the choices he made and all the comments he made about why he'd chosen this reading or that hymn. The main theme was love. And Brian picked this up, and in the end, when he typed it out, he typed the word love all in blue and bold all the way through. And it was there, 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 there. It was absolutely beautiful. And I think there was more love than I gave him credit for. Another thing that has me in tears is he was always very careful with his money. I think there wasn't much of it, and he knew he had to make it stretch. And just coming up 3 years ago, he managed to find enough money to get a stairlift fitted. And it's not just one stair lift, it's two, because I sleep in the roof in the loft extension. And I always reckon that was his last present for me. He wouldn't use it. He would not use it. He was all right. He could go up the stairs. But he knew I had trouble and go up on all fours. And Brian had fitted a handrail when he joined us. And he scrabbled around to find this money. And eventually, I think it was money he'd put by for our funerals. And because it was £12,000, it was a huge amount of money. And maybe for the next car, which we really rather need. But never mind. But anyhow, he did it. And I think, you know, that was his last gift to me somehow.
Well, that brings tears to your eyes.
Yes. I'm sorry I cry too easily. He had it very hard these last few years. I just hope I looked after him okay. That I did my duty. I just hope I did what I was supposed to do.
It sounds as if you did everything you could possibly do.
The last time he spoke to me, I said to him, we're going now. Because the boys would stay through the night and I would come back. Because this was over about a few weeks. And he said, where are you going? I said, I'm going home. And he said, where is home? So I couldn't think of anything to say, so I just gave him our address. And he died that night. This will be about 4 or 5 hours later. I wonder if he knew he was going home. His proper home. I don't know. I replay it now and again. One of those niggles, you know. You wonder.
I can see that it still hurts you, and you're very emotional about a lot of it. But how would you say you've got on? It's nearly a year. How have you made yourself get up in the mornings and get on with your day?
Well, I'm lucky because I'm a regular churchgoer. I get up and go to Mass every Sunday. And while I can still drive, I go on a Wednesday and Thursday as well, which makes me get up in the morning and get myself washed and dressed, which is good. But there are some days when I think I'll just go back to bed. I'm so tired. So there are some days when I don't get downstairs an awful lot before midday. I feel so ashamed of that. I ought to be up and moving. It's 88 next month. And I think, oh, you're old now. It's not surprising you feel tired and you don't walk very well. You need a stick or so.
How has your faith been helpful to you over the course of the last year?
Some people will say faith is just a prop, but it is a prop. It is enormously helpful. You can talk to God and explain how awful it is. You can even argue with him, but you can take all your troubles to him. And you know, whatever happens, when I die, somehow or other, and it is very somehow or other, we will be all together. I was with someone at the cemetery yesterday, and it's a very local cemetery in Old Windsor. And he was born in Old Windsor, and he said, I like to think of all the souls coming here, spirits, that's what he said, coming here and sitting on their stones and saying, oh, it's your turn now. I said, how long have you been here? And I thought that was really lovely.
So do you go there a lot?
No. We went yesterday, which was a nice thought. And we'll go next week, obviously. But it's not where he is. He's in heaven, please God.
Hazel, thank you so much for talking to me.
Well, as I say, thank you for asking.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.